Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a lockout. Correct that. We have two lockouts. Ahead in Only a Game, the NBA becomes the second American pro sports league unable or unwilling to hammer out a deal with its players. Also, the Los Angeles Dodgers swing for the Chapter 11 fences, and the tale of two stand-up guys who paddled standing up from Florida to Maine. Also ahead, author Dave Bedini relates tales of the homeless World Cup of soccer.
I didn't want to be too saccharine, but there were real, unavoidable moments of beauty and glory and wonder that existed within this tournament.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. At midnight on Thursday, the NBA's players joined their NFL brethren in lockout land. The NBA's decision to lock out their players had been anticipated, and nearly all the speculation about when this lockout will end has been pessimistic. Here to comment on the second major sports lockout this year is Mike Monroe of the San Antonio Express News. Mike, welcome to Only a Game.
It's great to be here.
The key issues negotiators failed to agree on were the player's share of all revenue and what type of salary cap would be in place. Are you surprised it's come to this after what many felt was a really memorable NBA season?
I'm not really surprised because for the better part of 2 years, the owners have been complaining about a system they say is broken. They're claiming losses in excess of $300 million per season. And they have asked for a major overhaul in the system through which nearly $4 billion in basketball-related income is divvied up with the players. So, surprised, no. What may be a surprise is how long I expect this lockout to last, which, as I sit here today in San Antonio, Texas, I think is going to be longer than shorter, maybe the entire 2011-12 season.
All league business is now suspended, and almost all contact is prohibited between team officials and players. According to the league, teams will be fined $1 million and will lose draft picks if they violate the lockout rules. What might be an example of a violation?
Contact between, say, a member of the basketball operations department, a general manager, or a player personnel director, really, or a coach, even a public relations person with any player. They're not allowed to speak to the players. This includes even athletic trainers and strength and conditioning people. The players are literally locked out. They cannot go to their to the locker room at the team's practice facility. They can't go to the weight room to lift weights. I mean, there's a 100% separation, and any team employee that violates this is going to be in deep and serious trouble, and the team will be subject to this $1 million fine.
From the beginning of the NFL lockout, only the most pessimistic observers felt that the entire NFL season might be lost, but many have claimed that this NBA lockout has seriously endangered the 2011-2012 season. Why is that?
Because I think the differences between the two sides are so gargantuan, to use a word that the union's executive director, Billy Hunter, has used, that I think it's going to be very, very difficult to bridge this gap. I've been led to believe by some people within the hierarchy of the NBA and some teams that as soon as the two sides meet again, the league, the Owners Labor Relations Committee, is going to inform the union that they're going back to their initial proposal, which proposed a $45 million hard salary cap and a give back of $1 million over the course of the 10-year agreement that they want in player salary. So if indeed this is what happens, it's going to create a really negative bargaining atmosphere, and it might lead to a decertification of the union, which when the lockout was announced, the union said they had no intention to decertify, as we know the NFL Players Union has done, and there's a suit in federal court that must be adjudicated.
The league has said that 22 of its 30 teams are losing money and that the league itself lost $300 million last season alone. Does the NBA need a radically different business model, as they've said, in order to be profitable? Do you believe that?
I believe that the league probably needs to amend the split of the basketball-related income. And in fact, the Players Union has offered to lower its share of that income. The players, of course, the union, is skeptical of the numbers the league has thrown around. The losses include amortization and depreciation of the players and debt service. And this is another reason that I'm a pessimist about the season, because I really do think the owners are in a hardline position. You know, there are a number of NBA owners who also own NHL hockey teams, and the NHL wiped out its entire season some years ago and got a collective bargaining agreement with its players union that is not a good one as far as the NBA players are concerned.
Union President Billy Hunter has said that the sides will meet again in 2 or 3 weeks. Now, given the current disagreements, is there any hope for progress at that time, or, as you have suggested, do we go backwards?
I think that first meeting is going to be ugly if, in fact, the owners take an even harder line than they've taken thus far. Everything I've been led to believe is that this is what's going to happen. So I'm not hopeful about that next meeting in 2 or 3 weeks. I've been led to believe there will be some back-channel negotiations in the interim, small meetings, phone calls, etc., perhaps setting the stage, and maybe that can forestall some sort of an ugly, ugly meeting. But I remain a pessimist, and I think we're headed for a bad situation.
Mike Monroe covers the NBA for the San Antonio Express News. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was a pleasure on my part, I guarantee you.
The Dodgers were once called Dem Bums by their fans in Brooklyn, but those Brooklyn fans said it with love, with resignation too, certainly, since the Dodgers made a habit of almost beating the Yankees and not doing so, but with real affection. Just ask the shades of Duke Snyder, Gil Hodges, and Jackie Robinson. These days, the Los Angeles Dodgers can be called Them Bankrupt Bums, or they could be if people in Los Angeles talk like that. The Dodgers not only can't win ball games these days, they can't make payroll without assistance, and the dirty laundry of those who own the club has been fluttering in the smoggy breeze for a couple of years. Here to help us figure out what has happened to baseball's most storied franchise ever to file for Chapter 11 is Bill Shaken of the LA Times. Bill, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
On Monday, the Dodgers filed for Chapter 11 protection. This was after the team had secured a $150 million loan so it could pay the bills and meet payroll. Has that stopped the bleeding for now?
Only for a couple weeks. What the bankruptcy court essentially authorized was funding to pay the immediate bills, the things that were coming due this week and the next payroll on July the 15th. On July 20th, everybody goes back to court and starts arguing all over again.
This week, the Dodgers dropped 2 out of 3 to the Twins, and after Wednesday's 1-0 loss, your colleague Dylan Hernandez referred to the Dodgers as, quote, a traveling tragicomedy. Does that seem an apt description to you?
Yeah. I mean, had the Dodgers been in first place, maybe some of the attention to the bankruptcy and some of the other off-the-field issues might be lessened a little bit, but it only becomes amplified every time you turn on a television set and see that the largest ballpark in the major leagues is half empty, and then you look at the standings and see the team is hovering right around last place.
Well, as you say, not exactly in first place. In fact, manager Don Mattingly said this week, and members of the team have agreed with him, saying, hey, we're better than the record would indicate. Are they right?
Frankly, they're not. They built their team around solid pitching and a questionable offense. The offense has indeed been questionable. The solid pitching really hasn't been there because of injuries. Jonathan Broxton, who was on the All-Star team as a closer last year, has been out most of the year with injuries. Hung Chi Kuo, who's an all-star setup man, has been out much of the year because he lost command. He's pretty much gotten it back, but that took some time. John Garland, who they signed to the starting rotation because he was reliable. He wasn't spectacular, but he never missed a start. He's been on the disabled list, too.
As you mentioned, the ballpark has been far from full, so fans have reacted that way. Are there other ways in which fans have expressed their dismay at the financial situation and McCourt's stewardship of the Dodgers?
There are people who have blogs and websites and have certainly made their opinion known with T-shirts they're trying to sell and such, but I think you're right. I mean, the attendance speaks for itself, and I think it's a little bit too simplistic to say that it's all about the ownership situation. The economy, of course, everywhere is not the greatest. And the Dodgers had a big security issue. There was a fan who was beaten nearly to death on opening day. And so the stadium is pretty much a Los Angeles Police Department controlled entity right now. So all those things come together to make it a place that is not one of the more popular gathering spots in Los Angeles right now.
The team and the league plan to present their bankruptcy plans in court on July 20th. Do you have any idea of what's likely to happen once those two sides meet in court?
The Dodgers have proposed a loan that they've gotten at what would be at least 10% interest, depending on how the loan works out. The league has come in and said, look, we can do better. We'll loan you the money at 7%. And, of course, those savings could be applied to the team operation, and that theoretically would make the team a little healthier. We'll have to see what the bankruptcy judge decides.
One somewhat grim possibility is that the league takes over the Dodgers. That would certainly prompt a flurry of legal actions. Do you think the commissioner will take over the team?
Well, the Dodgers argue that he essentially had, that he had appointed a trustee to oversee the team's finances. The league's position was, no, we're just keeping an eye on the team while we figure out what we want to do. And the Dodgers say, no, you knew what you wanted to do all along. You wanted to get us out of there. So that's another issue to be debated before the court.
The Pittsburgh Penguins once owed former player Mario Lemieux about $30 million, and he parlayed that into ownership of the team. The Dodgers now owe Manny Ramirez about $21 million. What do you think of Manny coming back as a co-owner?
It would be like having one of the stuntmen in the circus try to manage the circus. It just, I don't know that Manny would even care. He's a great person. If you talk to him, I know his performance obviously has had some issues, and his performance enhancing drug use is not something you'd recommend to anyone, but he's a good guy. He's not a guy, let's say, that has an MBA.
Bill, just one more question. You have to cover this team, you and your colleagues in Southern California. Has it been something that has been increasingly discouraging, or do you guys see it as just a cornucopia of story possibilities that you don't usually get to cover?
It's certainly different. I can't tell you that I'd ever thought I'd be spending my time as a baseball writer talking to divorce experts and bankruptcy experts, but here we are.
Bill Shaken covers the Dodgers for the Los Angeles Times. Bill, thank you very much for joining me.
All right, take care.
Austin and Pee Wee, and here I am, a poet, and I didn't even know it. So send the Phils to Trenton, the Giants to St. Paul, but keep the bums in Brooklyn, the greatest ball of all. So let's keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn. You heard our plea, at last we had our say. Your mind is in a park if you take them to that smock. Leave the Dodgers in Brooklyn, USA.
We really love them. Keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn, O'Malley.
Do me one favor. Mind your own business and stay home. Don't leave town.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. A variety of, quote, near hairless, toothy, and injured dogs were entered in the annual World's Ugliest Dog Competition at the Sonoma Marin Fair in California last month, and all but one of them were judged too attractive for the coveted distinction. This year's winner was a Chinese-crested Chihuahua named Yoda for his resemblance to the wise and wizened Jedi Master in Star Wars. The dog had been abandoned, and when her current owner, Terry Schumacher, first found the beast behind her apartment building, she thought it was a rat. Yoda's competition included a blind pug called Hercules and a one-eyed, bald mongrel named Handsome Hector, both of whom can only hope they'll become uglier with age. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a look at a homeless World Cup rife with redemption. Really. But first, Wimbledon 2011 has featured upsets, but not the upset lots of more or less local fans were rooting for. Rafael Nadal bounced back from a 1-set-to-none deficit to beat Scotland's Andy Murray yesterday afternoon. Joining me now from Wimbledon is Mr. Tennis himself, Bud Collins. Hi, Bud.
Bill, how are you?
Very well, thank you. We will get to a discussion of the finals, of course. But first, tell me if you were surprised that Roger Federer got bumped from the tournament in the quarters.
Well, I'm always surprised when he loses because he's an all-time great player. But I was doubly surprised with the way Sanga came through after losing the first two sets and then not allowing a break point the rest of the way and beating Roger. People were saying, oh, he's through. He's certainly not through. He's capable of winning major championships yet, in my view anyway. But Sanga, who's a big guy, fast, hit some incredible shots, and he went on to defeat. After that win, he got beat.
Bud, I've been trying to keep up with the tournament from this side of the Atlantic, of course, and it's been a little bit frustrating because most of the articles seem to be about the celebrities, royal and otherwise, watching the action rather than about the players. Has this been an especially celebrity-studded edition of Wimbledon?
Well, it seems to be more people considering themselves celebrities, I guess. There have been some names and faces that I almost recognize, but I wouldn't say any more so. It's a real magnet. People who are near Wimbledon want to go there, and it's always sold out.
Among the previous champions who will be watching the finals this time around are Serena and Venus Williams, but Maria Sharapova has returned to the Wimbledon final after an absence of 7 years, although I gather she was not exactly flawless in her semifinal match, which included a lot of double faults.
Yeah, she had 13 double faults. She served 48%, but she's very determined, and she is the favorite of the local bookmakers here. But I think she's going to have a good, tough time with Kvitova, who is the Czech from a small town in the Czech Republic, left-handed. Does that remind you of anybody?
Well, I was going to ask you that question. People have been saying, hey, she's a Czech, she's left-handed. This is Martina Navratilova all over again. It would seem to me it's a bit early for that comparison.
I would think so. Just as the German kid was being compared to Steffi Graf before she lost, so... You have to be a little patient.
Of course, Petra Kvitova has not been in a spotlight this bright before, unlike Maria Sharapova. How much will that matter?
Well, you just never know. I think Kvitova is going to do very well myself. She's got the big left-handed serve. She has a tremendous forehand. She was a semifinalist last year here when she took a set from the champion, Serena. So I think she's going to be all right. But Sharapova is in a great fettle. She's in love with a basketball player. And as I said to her, does every girl deserve a basketball player? And she said, well, if they get one like mine.
The men's final will match Novak Djokovic with Rafael Nadal. Djokovic has lost just one match this year. I'd have to guess that his confidence level is pretty high.
It's amazing, really. But I'll tell you, I'll give you a name you got to remember. Bernard Tomic, T-O-M-I-C, a young Australian who is going to bring the Aussies off their starvation diet after so many great years. He's 18 years old. He was a qualifier, and he was in a position to beat Djokovic. He didn't. It went 4 sets, but I think that's a name to remember, Tomic.
All right, Bud, it's time for predictions. So give us a winner on the women's side first, and then tell us who wins the men's final.
Well, I'm going to go with the left-hander, Kvitova. Maybe she's got some favors for Martina Navratilova. So I'm picking her in an upset. And on the other side with the men, I can never pick against Nadal. He just was tremendous against Andy Murray, and he moves so well. He injured his left foot the other day, but he was playing and has been playing on painkillers, injections. But the way he moved, you wouldn't know it. And he is a true treasure of sport. Like Federer, they're two of the greatest champions we've ever had.
Bud Collins has been writing about Wimbledon for the Boston Globe, and he joined me from London. Bud, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
In group play at the Women's World Cup in Germany, France, Germany, and Japan have distinguished themselves. Each of those teams has won twice. Most of the first-round games have been close, but Japan scored four times in shutting out Canada yesterday. New Zealand was eliminated from the tournament when they lost to England yesterday 2-1. The U.S. overcame a sluggish first half against North Korea to win their first match 2-0 on Tuesday. They will face Colombia today in Group C play. In today's second game, Sweden will attempt to make their way into the knockout round at the expense of North Korea. In 2003, soccer players of a sort from 18 nations gathered in Graz, Austria to stage the first homeless World Cup, a 4v4 tournament that's still going strong. When the 2011 edition of the event transpires next month, 64 nations will be represented. In Home and Away, subtitled One Writer's Inspiring Experience at the Homeless World Cup, Dave Bedini recalls his trip to the 2008 event in Australia with Team Canada. Dave Bedini joins me now from the CBC in Toronto. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, it's great to be back, Bill.
How did the Homeless World Cup come to be, and how did you come to be interested in it?
The genesis of the event was largely driven by a Scotsman, Mel Young, who's the chairman of the Homeless World Cup Foundation. He was sitting around with some friends during an international street newspaper conference, I believe it was in South Africa, and they were looking for an event as a way of raising awareness about street life. So they just sort of staged this first one in Graz, Austria. One of the other co-founders, it was Austrian, so that's why they had it there. And then it just sort of, the phone started to ring, and street soccer programs, of which there are countless in the world, contacted him, wanted to get involved. And by the time I got there in 2008, my first Homeless World Cup, 56 teams were taking part. I was completely unaware of this event, as many people are, until I discovered the heart of the Canadian street soccer program, which is located in downtown Toronto. And as it turns out, it was a block and a half from where I lived. So I was astonished to find this incredible athletic and social life happening so close to home. But I think in a way it is symbolic of, I think, of homelessness and street life in general in our cities, in that it exists, but very few of us are aware of it or at least acknowledge it. Frankly, they were kind of happy that I walked through the door and that I was interested in what they were doing.
You write that one of the first things the team from Finland did after arriving in Melbourne was to get to an AA meeting, but the team from Canada quickly established the record for, quote, the most beer consumed at a homeless sporting event. I wonder how the organizers feel or whether they worry about records like that.
I don't think the organizers really knew that it was happening, to be honest. I was quite surprised to find that there would be any kind of alcoholic presence whatsoever. But the players that Team Canada brought had not dealt with those addictions specifically. And one of the players who had a very, very bad OxyContin addiction, painkiller addiction, didn't seem to be such a big deal for him to have swill a pint every now and then. Again, Paul, the coach, when I asked him why there were flats of beer in their apartment in Melbourne, he said, you know, we're a Canadian sports team on the road. Without beer, it just wouldn't be normal. And he wanted to make it as normal as possible for the players.
Dave, you write that one of the aims of the Homeless World Cup has been to confront what you call the invisibility of homelessness. One paragraph in the chapter titled 500 Miles speaks powerfully to that issue by describing a parade that was part of the opening ceremonies in Melbourne. Would you read that paragraph in the middle of page 57, please?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot, Bill. The athletes soon filled the heart of the thoroughfare, pushing everyone else to the margins of the street. Along the route, parade-goers raised their hands to high-five the players, and almost every player was quick to return the touch. The moment was fat with irony. Having spent years being ignored or sneered at by passers-by, to say nothing of suffering cruelty, beatings, and for those who weren't here, death at the hands of police, miscreants, and thugs, The homeless were now being cheered in the fullness of the Australian sunshine. To move alongside them was to swim in the butterscotch of the moment, the players behaving as if loosed from years of hardship and social poison. It was a thrilling moment, Bill.
Did any of the players speak to you about what it was like specifically to be, quote, cheered in the fullness of the sunshine?
They were almost wordless, really. We all gathered on buses at the University of Melbourne where all the teams were staying and headed into town. I don't think anyone really knew what to expect. There had been previous homeless World Cup parades, like the Parade of Athletes. There was none of the pageantry. The reception was nothing like what it was in Melbourne. And it was midday, too, and right in the heart of the city. So a lot of people would have been on their lunch breaks. And it was just starting to get warm in Australia at the time. So it was amazing because you had legions of men and women in their business suits, you know, their suits and ties, eating their bagged lunch. And they all kind of came to the edge of the curb. And suddenly this moment happened where, you know, a group of people started cheering and then the cheering got louder and louder and kind of roiled along through the city until they ended up entering the stadium, which was a small pitch in Federation Square, which was right in the heart of Melbourne. It was packed. There were 4,000 people in the stands for this opening game. Part of the thing that I had to struggle in terms of writing this book was to not make it come across sounding like a script for a Disney feel-good film. But there were real, you know what I mean? I didn't want to be too saccharine, but there were real unavoidable moments of beauty and glory and wonder that existed within this tournament. And that was only one of them.
For one of the players on the Canadian team, a young woman named Crystal, the Homeless World Cup had an especially powerful impact. Tell us about what Crystal was coming from and what the event led to for her.
Crystal drew a lot of attention at the event because she was one of the few women playing on one of the integrated teams. Just a bit of background, her mother was a prostitute in a very difficult corridor in the inner city here. Who died of AIDS when Crystal was two. So Crystal was sent to a foster home, and then she was adopted into a family outside of the city where she had, I think, a pretty normal life up until her early teenage years. When she started to rebel, and when she rebelled, she really rebelled hard, ran away from home, lived in sheds and garages with a friend, people she didn't really know, who eventually turned on her. There was a history of sexual abuse with her as well. And when they were putting the team together for Melbourne, it was really a no-brainer to name Crystal. And when she arrived in Melbourne, she captured everybody's hearts for her play, for her drive, for her intensity, for her goodwill as well. She ended up setting a record for the amount of goals scored by a woman in the tournament. And seeing her perform the way she did with the men of Team Canada has since inspired about 50% of the teams to make their teams truly integrated for the subsequent tournaments.
And Crystal, I gather, has gone on to play soccer.
Yeah, she's tried out for the under... She's only 18 years old. She tried out for the under-19 national team. She didn't make it, but she's going to keep trying every year. But more importantly, she's back in school, and she's working on getting her high school degree. And, you know, her life was so foggy for so long, and from these experiences, she can... You know, there's a little bit of light creeping through, and she can see a point in the horizon that she can direct her life towards. You know, before I got involved in this program, the Homeless World Cup has this literature that states that 70% of people who participate in the tournament either, you know, reconnect with their family, get off their addiction, and get some sort of shelter. And again, I thought that was very Disney-fied. I thought they were bringing out the violins, you know. But to see it actually come to play, especially on the four people who traveled with Team Canada, was remarkable. Everybody, you know, knock wood, it's a perilous life. And a precarious life, but everybody is doing great. Actually, Billy Pagonis, one of the players who was a former professional in Canada, who was the one addicted to painkillers, he's now coaching the Canadian team, which is part of the mandate of a lot of street soccer programs around the world. Because if you know you're talking about homelessness and the homeless condition and homeless people, who better to kind of direct those programs than people who've been on the streets themselves?
How good is the soccer at one of these events?
Part of the issue I think that the Homeless World Cup have had to deal with lately is the fact that some of it is very, very good and some of it is very, very poor. Canada lost to Chile at 1.32-0. Nobody gained anything from that experience, you know. I think it partly illuminated the Chilean soccer psyche, homeless or otherwise. So they're trying to deal with that. The psychology between the teams in terms of making up their roster is quite different from country to country to country. The Irish team, you know, many of them recovering heroin addicts, all of them homeless at one point, were all very, they're almost suspiciously fit. The Germans were similar, the Scots, the Russians certainly. Whereas, you know, the Canadians, the Belgians, the Swedes, and the Finns, they reflected you or I a little bit more. They were more sort of just regular people. Some teams go there to win. In fact, I was actually, you know, being a Canadian, I was suspicious of the American team because I thought, you know, it's an international sporting event. The Americans are not going to want to go home with their tail between their legs. But Lawrence Cann, who runs the program there, really does it right. You know, he names players to the team who, no matter what their soccer skills, are the ones that are going to benefit most from the experience.
The word redemption is overused in the context of sports, but maybe it's fair to say that some of the participants in the Homeless World Cup did find redemption in soccer, at least in part. Would you agree?
I think so. Dealing with homelessness and, you know, issues of addiction and being disconnected from one's family throughout your life, it's a constant work in progress. But for that moment, I believe there was a certain amount of personal redemption. And whether that came in play, whether that came in, you know, just socially mixing with the other players, whether it came from hearing about the experiences of the West Africans, whether it came from hearing from the Cambodian kids who played, you know, a team of 14-year-olds who grew up in the dumps of Phnom Penh, I think they gleaned enough that they were able to feel that it was them who were there hearing these stories, being among these people, among their fellow citizens. It was these athletes, this set of athletes who were experiencing that. And I think that that was a great source of pride and redemption for them.
Dave Bedini is the author of Home and Away, One Writer's Inspiring Experience at the Homeless World Cup. It's published by Skyhorse, and Dave Bedini joined me from the CBC in Toronto. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's always a great pleasure, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Any number of locales can lay claim to the distinction City of Champions. It's a designation that surfaces each time two or more teams located in New York, Chicago, Boston, Los Angeles, or some other burg claim titles within a few years of each other. But how many cities can claim to lead the United States in terms of sitting around? Only one, according to Men's Health magazine, which recently determined that Louisville, Kentucky is the nation's most sedentary city. Jackson, Mississippi, and Indianapolis, Indiana gave the citizens of Louisville a run for their money, or they would have if anybody in either of those places ever got off their sofas. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, paddling over the bounding Maine to Maine from Florida. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Is the Maine really bound? I've looked at the Maine. It doesn't bound. It just sort of wrinkles.
Bound on it.
Okay.
Anyway, the last time two of the top four sports leagues were locked out at the same time, it was the NHL and Major League Baseball in late 1994 and early 1995. This time, it's the NBA and the NFL. Is it the leagues involved that make this time seem more dire?
Well, I think that the anything the NFL does, the NFL, as much as some of us on this show may not want to believe it, is the great gravitational force in American sports. And when anything happens in the NFL, it looks more dire than anything else. The fans of the NBA have more to worry about because the owners seem to be united behind David Stern, whereas Roger Goodell is in the position of one of the latter-day bourbons in France at this point. I would be watching the valet parking for tumbrils.
The NBA and its union are, as you suggest, said to be far apart, both financially and, I'm quoting now, philosophically, whatever that means. Some sources are saying that a best-case scenario might be an agreement in September. Does this mean we're going to have to suffer through at least three more months of good lockout talk?
I suspect so. I mean, you know, and I have to say that having been to several, more than several football training camps, if football training camp were to be reduced to, oh, I don't know, half an hour, I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. NBA training camp's a little bit more interesting. You know why, Bill? Because at NBA training camps, they play basketball.
They shoot basketball.
At training camp, for NFL training camps, nobody plays football.
Meanwhile, the NFL and its players negotiated for 15 and a half hours into the wee hours on Friday morning and then came back 6 hours later to talk some more. I hope this is a good sign.
What does it mean, though? I mean, they met for 15 hours and, you know, argued over the dessert tray. I mean, the 15 hours means nothing, except they might well be putting on a good dumb show. I think they're probably a little closer because I think, as I said, I think Roger Goodell realizes that his footing as commissioner is not quite as firm as he'd like it to be.
Meanwhile, in the other professional football league, the head of the Bowl Championship Series met with the Department of Justice this week in an attempt to prove that there is nothing illegal about the way the college football champion is determined. BCS Director Bill Hancock described the meeting as, quote, friendly. So I'm wondering if the Department of Justice is playing possum.
There's no such thing as a friendly meeting with the Department of Justice. That is like an informal chat with the FBI, okay? The Department of Justice calls you in for a meeting. Unless you happen to be redecorating the building in Washington, it's because they think you've done something.
Carpet samples. We're here with carpet samples.
I don't know why the Department of Justice is even messing with this, but it's pretty plain that they see something amiss in the BCS besides the fact that a lot of sports writers hate it.
A jury has awarded $10 million to the parents of Eric Plancher, the University of Central Florida football player who died during an off-season workout. The jury found the university was negligent after head coach George O'Leary had drinking water and athletic trainers removed from the workout. UCF will appeal the decision. I wonder if they'll also reconsider Coach O'Leary's future employment.
Oh, I don't understand how he still has a job. I really don't. I'm sort of willing to give him another chance after the resume puffing that cost him the Notre Dame job. This is insane. Pulling water away from football players during training camp when you have a team in Florida, that's crazy. It doesn't prove anything. There are coaches in America who have won a lot more football games than George O'Leary will ever win, who managed to perform their jobs with a minimum of sadism.
This week, Major League Baseball was apparently preparing to, quote, seize the Los Angeles Dodgers. Will gunboats be involved?
I have no idea. I mean, this is once again Bud Selig ignoring the beam in his own eye, namely the Mets, to go for the mote in the Dodgers' eye. I know he doesn't want Frank McCourteau in the Dodgers anymore, but the fact remains is that he's overstepping his bounds in a wild way here.
Do you agree with Nolan Ryan, the president of the Texas Rangers, that moving the Houston Astros into the American League would create instantly a great rivalry?
Well, he would know Texas better than I would, God knows. And he seems to think that if you could throw him in the division with the Rangers, it might make a lot of competitive and baseball sense. I, for one, wouldn't be against it.
The 2011 edition of Wimbledon has featured a great many upsets. Did you see Joe Wilfried Tsonga's bouncing of Roger Federer coming?
Pardon me. Tsonga!
That was coming.
Yes, I did. And every time he hit a winner, I said, Tsonga!
Never has a man had more fun watching a tennis match.
The man should lose his first name and simply be Tsonga!
The women's final, which transpires today, will feature Maria Sharapova and Petra Kvitova. Ms. Sharapova has set the record for loudest on-court grunting, but I guess that need not trouble those following the match on the radio.
Yeah, there's an anti-grunt noise reduction technology that's been developed specifically for those people who listen to women's tennis on the radio. Who listens to tennis on the radio, by the way?
I was wondering the same thing. Bud Collins suggested to me years ago that he'd like to do that, and there were no takers.
Well, I just remember at the U.S. Open, a long time ago when I covered the U.S. Open every year, there was a guy who used to broadcast all of Mats Wilander's matches back to Sweden, shot by shot. This man sounded like the most boring person. If you remember, Mats Wilander was not exactly your serve and volley guy. And there was a lot of... Vidderhurt for 13 days.
The Tour de France begins today in a French town. I can't pronounce, Charlie. The defending champion, Spain's Alberto Contador, has a decent chance of repeating, but he also has a decent chance of having last year's victory and this year's result thrown out in court due to positive doping tests. Sounds like deja vu all over again.
Yes, Alberto Contador is trying for his second straight win in the Tour de Pharmacy.
It's hard work going up those hills, and we shouldn't laugh, but they've
Give me
it.
A break, right. Would you please? The guy's got one drug test, you know, hanging over last year, and he's starting the race again.
Robert Garrigues, who finished in a tie for third at the U.S. Open, announced this week that when he was playing on the Nationwide Tour, which is sort of the minor leagues for the PGA Tour, he would celebrate completing the first nine holes of a round with marijuana. I'm curious about why he felt compelled to bring that up just now.
Well, he's doing a rehab story for himself now. But I got to tell you, this doesn't say very much about the size of the galleries on the Nationwide Tour. Because I don't, without opening myself up to criminal prosecution.
Careful.
I've been in rooms where a lot of people were smoking dope. And you can generally tell. If you got, and he says a lot of people on the Nationwide Tour did. If you got four or five golfers walking down the fairway, all of them, you know, like smoking dope, someone's going to notice if they're in the gallery.
And isn't
Apparently,
it
no
likely
one did.
That at least one of those golfers would curl up in a sand trap and go to sleep?
Well, either that or start eating.
Demand Oreos?
Start eating the plant life in the rough.
Before I let you go, last week we discussed Ron Artest's intention to change his name to Meta World Peace, and neither of us knew what Meta, M-E-T-T-A, meant. And several listeners, including Dana S. Leslie, who hears the program on WRNI in Rhode Island, wrote to inform us that Meta is a Sanskrit word often translated as loving kindness. Is your appreciation for the fellow once known as Ron Artest greater than ever?
Yeah, well, yes, but my appreciation for the depth of knowledge of the Only a Game audience continues to grow. I mean, Meta with two T's is apparently the Sanskrit word. I, of course, dropped my introductory to Sanskrit course at Marquette University halfway through the first semester, so I don't think we got
didn't
to compound
get meta.
Didn't get to compound words yet, I think. Yeah.
And finally, Charlie, I'll bet you've been wondering for years now how Charlie Sheen so successfully impersonated a Major League pitcher in the movie Major League. And this week, the explanation became clear, right?
He juiced. The Cleveland Indians are going to have their pennant marred forever by the fact that their star relief pitcher juiced himself so he could get the fastball from 79 to 85 miles an hour. First of all, what's less surprising? That he actually did it or that he's admitting now that he did it?
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and various other books, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Tonga!
A little before 2 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, on the deck outside a restaurant overlooking a nondescript dock in Portland, Maine, a couple dozen patrons, some of them fortified with beer, await the arrival of Mike Simpson and Will Rich. For the past 4 months, Simpson and Rich have been making their way north from Key West, Florida, on two stand-up paddle boards. As their parents and assorted others peer out into the bay, they see ferry boats and fishing boats and the odd sailboat, and then finally two guys standing on their boards, raising their paddles over their heads.
Yeah. Hey, where you been?
Where'd you go?
Will Rich hits the dock sporting a bushy beard of brown, blonde, and red. He tells me he got tired of shaving sometime shortly after St. Patrick's Day. Since he and Mike have been quoted as saying they find paddling a board energizing, I ask him if that's how he feels now.
I'm full of all different types of things going on right now, so don't even know if words can describe it. Energize is pretty good.
When Mike Simpson bumps up against the dock, he's already talking.
We've been underway now since March 1st, 90 days exactly of paddling days, 31 days off, and here we are. We've been in pea soup fog since 8 o'clock this morning.
just waiting out there for a crowd to gather, huh?
We did stop and pick up some trash because I called my mother and she wasn't anywhere near here. So we had to wait a little bit.
She's up there now, you're telling me?
She's right there.
A few minutes later, mother and son are reunited and hugging.
Hi, Mama. Hi, hi.
Mike Simpson's father, Henry, is on the deck as well. After embracing his son, he tries to talk a little about what Mike and Will have accomplished.
Just today was the culmination of the most awesome venture that two men could undertake, I think, and for a cause much greater than their own, for what they were doing it for. And sorry, but to be here for the end of it, knowing what they've been through, and just undertaking it, and for the reason they undertook it, it's just something that you just don't think of, that your child's going to do that.
The greater cause of which Henry Simpson speaks is the Wounded Warrior Project, which Mike Simpson and Will Rich adopted as their own before they departed Key West. The project was started by several veterans and their friends who were determined to help wounded soldiers returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The assistance ranges from counseling to medical help and advice about jobs and training. And Jennifer Herdman, Community Engagement Coordinator for the organization, appreciates the efforts of Simpson and Rich.
The attention that they've received, the awareness that they were able to raise for Wounded Warrior Project is incredible. They've reached the coastline all the way up the eastern seaboard, and that's phenomenal outreach for us. You know, it's creative, it's different, it's exciting. We're just honored that they would support us.
On the dock in Portland, there are T-shirts for sale commemorating the coastal paddle, proceeds to benefit the Wounded Warriors. Nobody from the organization is on hand for the landing, though Jennifer Herdman tried to connect with the paddlers early in their voyage.
They were making a landing in Jacksonville Beach. I know that they were going to the lifeguard station, so I came bearing gifts, stickers for their paddle boards and T-shirts for them. And when I arrived, they weren't there yet. I never saw them.
That failure to connect could not have been entirely unexpected, given the vicissitudes of a 4-month journey via paddle. The attempt to get across Chesapeake Bay was delayed several days by bad weather, then interrupted by more bad weather when Simpson and Rich were 3 hours into the crossing and had to head for land. Nor did the difficulties end there. According to Mike Simpson, even on the trip's final day off the main coast, there were challenges, specifically the aforementioned fog.
I can't even see anything. We're literally listening to the waves hit the rocks, and at one point, Will's going one way, and I said, "Shouldn't we go over there?" And he said, "Over where?" I'm like, "Well, I hear the surf over there, so I think we should." He's like, "Oh, yeah, yeah, that makes sense." And then we saw some people out at the lighthouse out there. They were blown away, just like, really, where are you coming from? That's pretty crazy. So they told them we were coming from Key West. Their minds blew out of their head.
As the storytelling winds down, it's easy to suppose that Simpson and Rich must be thinking about how good it feels to be back among family and friends after 4 months of paddling, or waiting for days calm enough for same, 4 months of nights spent with the keepers of lighthouses and other strangers disposed to kindness. Or are they already thinking of another extreme adventure? Mike's father, Henry, is in no hurry to find out.
We're not asking that question. I don't want to know that. I don't want to know that.
Ah, then perhaps Mr. Simpson shouldn't talk to his wife just now, because apparently Mike has already let Mom in on the next project he's planning.
With Michael? Yeah, he already wants to do the Missouri River all by himself solo, just like Lewis and Clark. I think that's what he thinks his next adventure. Would you like to follow him?
Marion Simpson was not shocked when her son told her about the plan to paddle aboard from Key West to Portland. He'd already kayaked the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, done a lot of extreme skiing, and ridden some of the biggest waves Hawaii had to offer. On the other hand, Robin Rich, Will's mother, has not quite gotten used to her role as mom to an extreme adventurer.
It's been a long 4 months. I worry every day. And I'm just so glad it's over. Having my son home.
We try and keep him on land for a little while now?
There's no holding him back. He's quite the adventurer, so I don't know. We'll see.
Robin Rich is proud of her son for publicizing the Wounded Warrior Project. She also wonders out loud if maybe the trip he's just finished will help to popularize the previously obscure sport of stand-up paddling.
You know, I hadn't heard of it until he started, and now it's everywhere. We live in Gloucester, and there's a stand-up paddleboard company there. There's one in Manchester, Mass. And I guess there was an article about some fellow in Hawaii who did it. So it's anybody can do it.
Well, perhaps not anybody. But if the activity does catch on big time, those few of us who were on that dock in Portland on Wednesday will be able to say we were present for a seminal moment in paddleboarding's explosion, which, as Mike Simpson and Will Rich might say, on a sunny weekday afternoon beats sitting at a desk. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Allison Gluck, and we had help this week from Leanne McDonald at CBC Toronto. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our stand-up paddling pictures, and they are stand-up pictures, or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Marion Simpson, mother of stand-up paddler Mike Simpson.
Actually, I told him last night, don't get there before 2.
Ah, sure, Mom. We'll just hang here off the coast on these little boards among the sharks and the whales, in the fog, cold, while you make your way to the restaurant. Sure. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.